This meeting of the House Heads Committee called to order on February 9th, 1994 at 3:05 p.m. Representative Cynthia Tui presiding, committee members present are. Laura Lee, would you please call the roll?
Representative Tui.
Here.
Representative Bundy.
Here.
Representative Davis.
Here.
Excuse me, I'm sorry.
Oh, Gary Davis.
Representative
Beasy. Here.
Representative Cott. Representative Olberg.
Here.
Representative Gary Davis. Representative Nikolai.
Here.
Representative Bryce.
I'm Betty Davis.
Because you've got Betty Davis eyes.
A quorum is present. Okay, you guys, settle down. A quorum is present. On today's calendar, we have House Bill 376, Assist and Protect Vulnerable Adults, as well as House Bill 377, Regulations of Assisted Living Homes. We will be hearing House Bill 376, Assist and Protect Vulnerable Adults first. Commissioner Yusur is with us today, if you'd like to come to the table. And please begin your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With your permission, what I'd like to do is give a brief overview of both 376 and 377 and sort of a global view of where we're going with the structuring of senior services. And then Connie Sipe, who is the new director of the Division on Senior Services, is with us and can speak more specifically to a specific overview on each bill. Would that meet with your approval?
That'd be just fine.
Thank you. As you know, the governor formed a task group, a working group, about a year and a half, almost 2 years ago now, to look at the continuum of care for seniors. We've been concerned that as we have seen, you know, changes to what we've considered to be the traditional seniors programs in the state with Pioneer Homes and with Longevity Bonus and with a growing population of seniors, how can we best provide for this group to instill and foster independence and dignity for people and to deal with them as individuals as opposed to having sort of global broad programs that try to be all things to all people. What we're seeing is that the very diverse needs of this senior population need to be met in a variety of ways, and that we needed to find ways to do that that were more creative than the programs that we currently had. Much of what is in both of these two bills, much of what is in these bills, was the result of input from the Older Alaskans Commission and the Pioneer Home Advisory Board, as well as a variety of seniors organizations, including AARP and OPEG, throughout the state. It is also the result of a unique collaborative effort on the part of the Department of Health and Social Services and the Department of Administration, as well as with the input from Community and Regional Affairs. The working group really came up with three proposals, one of which is not before you today, but I will give you just a brief mention of it because I think it's central. It's the underpinning of these other initiatives, and that is the consolidation of senior services, state-provided senior services, into a single division where we have a single point of contact for seniors to be able to access the variety of programs available to them. Clearly, it didn't make any sense to have a system where we had seven different divisions in state government providing services to a single population. It is this group of Alaskans that make these programs common to one another, not the function of the program. And with that, I will speak specifically to House Bill 276, which is the Adult Protection Bill. Adult protection services heretofore was provided by the Department of Health and Social Services, where they were grouped together by the function. It was the protective aspect of it and not the populations being served. It doesn't take a lot to all of a sudden, when you start thinking about it, that the way we interact and deal with adults is very, very different than the way we deal with children. Children are not capable of making informed decisions, making decisions for themselves, and consequently we have a different responsibility to them. Adults in most cases need to be treated as adults. I mean, these aren't they're not children. They're not people that need to be cared for and patronized. They need to be dealt with as independent, mature human beings, and which is what this direction takes, is moving them out of having a like group of children as customers and moving them in with seniors and other programs. We think that's a real important structural change in the way we view this population, is that they do have needs that are very unique and very different. I'm not going to get into the specifics. I'll leave that for Connie on how, what specific changes are made, but I wanted to touch on the policy of grouping that together. The second thing that we found was incredibly important for the seniors today was to provide or to fill this huge gap that we had in the continuum of care. What we have in the state today is really home care-based services, senior housing services, and then nursing homes, full institutionalization. And there was a huge gap in this middle of what about people who may need help with daily living? What about people who don't need 24-hour nursing care, but really are not as able to get around independently in their own homes as they used to? And is there a single answer? And the answer that we came up with was no, there is no one solution. But the assisted living concept, which provides a social model for providing for people's needs, offers a wide range of opportunities for people to get the kind of help that they need in their homes, that is their communities, in their towns, where they're near family and friends, and to have community-based services available to them to the extent that they need them. And it really is a consumer-oriented program that seniors are provided the opportunity to buy services in ways that are going to be most meaningful to them, short of nursing home care, but beyond full independent living. This bill provides a licensing of those kinds of facilities and provides for opportunities for people to participate in those kinds of programs. These two approaches, together with the reorganization, certainly will move our ability to provide for seniors in the state forward dramatically. It's not everything. We understand that it is not, this doesn't fill all the gaps, and that there are certainly still a number of things that need to be done, but we think that this is a huge move forward in being able to provide a stronger safety net for the seniors of Alaska. I would be happy to answer any questions. If there are none of me, I'd be happy to have Connie come up and sort of go through a sectional so you have a specific understanding of what these bills do.
Thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I have one question. I just want to clarify for not only my sake. Does this mean that if a person chooses to stay in their own home, that these assisted living services will also fill in?
It's possible, but that's not the intent. Right now, home care services are provided as part of Project Choice to Medicaid-eligible Alaskans that are home care services where people actually come in and perform those things at home. The governor signed that Medicaid waiver 2 years ago under Project Choice. There are a number of other support services that are available through regular Older Alaskans Commission grants to people in the homes, caravan services, Meals on Wheels, that sort of thing. The assisted living licensing, the reason I'm hedging on it, it's not a simple yes or no. It is conceivable, for example, that I have a home and I want to have two or three other seniors come in and then we have someone come live with us who takes care of it. You could become licensed in assisted living. It is as flexible as that you could accommodate that. But generally what these are designed to do is provide opportunities for people to move into facilities that could be as few as four people or as many as 40 or unlimited in having the kind of services that are available. And they are home-like atmospheres. This isn't a hospital or a nursing home model at all. It is a social model. It is where people would have a room, it can be an apartment. A very homely
rooming house.
Right. That's a real good description.
Thank you. you'll be waiting. If there's anybody that wishes to testify on any of these bills, and if you've not done so, would you sign up in the back, please, so that we'll have you on record? And then please, for the record, when you do speak, make sure you give your name and for Laura Lee. It just makes things less confusing. Thank you. If you'd like to come, yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Connie Seip, and I'm the Director of the Division of Senior Services, formerly known to you as the Executive Director of the Older Alaskans Commission, but I'm not wearing that hat anymore. If I can go over with you first, the Bill on Protection for Vulnerable Adults, and again, I would kind of like to hit the highlights and then go into some more of the sections. This bill is a revision of current law, and it would transfer the authority for adult protective services from Family and Youth Services to the Department of Administration. And now, the Division of Senior Services is who would do it, but the bill doesn't mention divisions because we don't do that when we draft statutes. We just mention the department. And this is the protection for all vulnerable adults from age 18 on. And there was discussion and work with the Department of Health and Social Services about the fact that all adults are more like each other in terms of how we should deal with them on protective services than they are like children, and that we would move them all out, but that the number of resources the state has to deal with adults and protective services right now is limited to 3 social workers, and so we didn't want to further split them. We have a very good working relationship between Division of Senior Services and the Division of Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities, which has the programmatic services for most vulnerable adults under age 60, and so we have agreed, we work together on Project Choice and other things, that we could collaborate in terms of serving these clients, and that's how we will do it. The bill itself combines two former bills. There used to be an elder abuse reporting bill and a disabled abuse reporting bill. We had 2 statutes. It combines the 2 statutes into one and calls it protection of vulnerable adults. It offers protection to the vulnerable, and it tries to interfere less with elderly or disabled adults who are capable of caring for themselves and making their own decisions. It doesn't just talk about abuse to any adult, but abuse to a vulnerable adult, someone who appears not to be capable of protecting themselves, making their own decision, or preventing the abuse. It streamlines abuse reporting and tries to reduce the duplicate work by some state investigative agencies. Right now, if there's abuse, say, in something like a facility, a nursing home, you have jurisdiction of up to 4 state agencies. We are not able, because of federal law, to totally bring that down to 1 agency, but we've gotten the protective services social worker out of that, and we give the jurisdiction to the licensing agency for that nursing home and the long-term care ombudsman to investigate the abuse under this statute and then to give their report back to the central reporting agency. So we've tried to better use government resources that we have and streamline how many different agencies a facility or an alleged perpetrator of abuse has to respond to. We are going to promote more, open a central information referral office for all the vulnerable adults and their caregivers. And in addition, I think open up how we deal with local care providers so that we can use local service providers more to reach the population. Often, a senior will know someone already from the senior center, and an outreach call from a senior center rather than from a social worker or a village safety officer, someone knocking on the door, might be a quite more acceptable form of an offer of help or outreach to see if there's a problem that someone wants to talk about than to send someone in a formal investigative sense. And so to the extent agencies are willing and are already working with the same population, whether it's a developmentally disabled somebody like Access Alaska, who has a grant to help with folks, or a senior center, a case management agency, if they're willing, we would have power under this bill to enter into designation agreements with them, honor confidentiality, and so on, and use them to do some of the preliminary outreach to people that would be more friendly to the user. We would honor, of course, and this is in current law, a competent adult's refusal of services or request to terminate the investigation. We would share appropriate information on the status of the investigation with the reporter of the abuse. Under current confidentiality law, is so strictly interpreted that many times the person who actually, or sometimes a caregiver, or a facility, or say an adult daycare center that reported the abuse, finds itself unable to get enough information back to know that their client is in fact safe, or that they're still dealing appropriately with their client. We have put in something that we hope will reduce the burden on families and agencies of always having to get a guardianship for situations which appear to be temporary, when an adult is not able to temporarily consent to services, but after medical treatment or whatever may be in a better shape. That we have put in a provision that follows state laws in about 18 states to call surrogate decision makers. It allows families, the protective service agency, medical providers to honor the decision of a surrogate decision maker in the family, and there's a whole order set out of who gets honored, only when the senior or the adult cannot make their own decision. whether it looks like it's temporary or it might be permanent and we might have to go eventually for a full guardianship, but that we can make immediate protective service decisions then if the adult is not capable of making decisions, perhaps is ill right now or is in a withdrawal mode or has hypothermia. And we have consent problems which now cause everyone to run to the courthouse and seek a guardianship, which takes a great deal of time and a lot of state resource. It clarifies also when and for what relief the state can go into the court and seek some judicial intervention, including something like the domestic violence writ, where we can ask for an injunction to get a perpetrator to stop the activity or stop interfering with services to the vulnerable adult. It also, and I think a lot of the body of the bill is actually in the last few pages in the definitions. After some work and years of the Older Alaskans Commission working with Family and Youth Services, working with providers around the state, we found that we needed some new definitions of abuse. Abuse is redefined to focus on things that are intentional or reckless, not just accidental harms to adults. Today, literally, even accidental harm to an elder must be reported. And that was causing, I think, a misuse of state resources when we don't have enough. And we thought that it was much better to refocus on those things that appear to be reckless or intentional or willful. We also redefine neglect to focus on intentional failure by a caregiver to provide care, not just the inability to care through poverty or through illness themselves. We redefined exploitation to include exploitation of the victim's person as well as resources. We have had times when people are exploited in their person. Also that their resources are exploited. The current law only talks about economic harm caused by fraud or duress or theft. And the new exploitation talks about any taking of undue advantage of a person's resources so that the personal care attendant who eventually helps her client drain away her bank account on trips to the South Seas could be taking undue advantage, but might not qualify under the kind of current common law definitions of what theft and fraud are. So we've redefined exploitation. And remember, all of this is in a civil context. This is not a criminal law. This is not something for what the state prosecutes. This is something for which the state sends in protective social workers, if necessary, to offer services to the family, if necessary, to go to court and to seek guardianships or conservatorships for a person, or to see if the person needs to be confined for a possible mental evaluation. But it is not a criminal statute. So when we talk about these new things about exploitation and abuse, we are not setting up new criminal penalties. We are setting up a new reporting system and a new system about what will the state take into its account, where the state will somewhat interfere to see if the person is safe enough, knows the choices they're making, has the services that they might want if they knew that they had access to those services. And then the final parts of the bill provide basically for a smooth transition and transfer between departments. There are sections at the back that talk about ongoing cases continue under the current laws and aren't dropped so that we have a smooth and orderly transition of all cases and assets. So that's an overview of the bill that picks out the highlights, and I'd be glad to answer any questions or to do a further sectional analysis.
Thank you. Would the record please show that Representative Davies arrived at 208 and Representative Codd arrived at 218.
Three.
I beg your pardon. And 318 and 308. Representative Gary Davis, thank you. Are there any questions from the committee? I beg your pardon.
Stop drumming your finger, Madam Chairman.
Oh, excuse me.
Gotcha.
Are there any?
Yes.
Representative Bundy.
Madam Chairman, thank you. A question about the fiscal notes, fiscal notes in plural. We have some increments and some decrements. What's the total net loss or gain in state revenues achieved with 376?
Representative Bundy and Representative Chairman Tui, actually, it's a total transfer. The current resources now in Family and Youth Services are about $563,000, and those will transfer in total to the Division of Senior Services. There will be three PCNs that will transfer, and as well as all the various contract and support money. The contract money in that budget at Family and Services is fairly large because it is used to pay for protective adult foster care or adult residential care when the person cannot pay for it themselves or for other emergency protective services, mostly of a lodging sort of variety. Traditionally, over the last couple of years, the analysis shows that less than that full contractual amount has been used for the protective placement. And what will be done as that money transfers into Division of Senior Services is that we will be using empty positions from within our division to create a few more positions to handle this. Because obviously, although DFYS has 3 full-time social workers devoted to this, they do have all their other branch offices, and they can call upon someone in Seward or somewhere else to occasionally handle an adult case. So we will be trying to create 2 more positions for this position out of those funds, and we feel that we can adequately handle still the contractual amounts because we'll be putting more people into Project Choice and other funding sources for their care. There is no decrease or increase in state funding.
Thank you.
Representative Veazey.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Could you tell me what the penalty for a violation of this proposed statute would be?
Representative Veazey, through the chairs, the only part of the statute that has any penalty is the reporting, the duty on professionals who are listed in the first part of the bill to report harm when they see abuse. That has, I believe it's a Class B felony if they don't report. Let me double check that I haven't forgotten my statute. It's at the top of kind of buried. It's a Class B. Pretty sure it's a Class B felony if you fail to report. Plus, it can be reported to your licensing board if you're a professional and you have failed to report as required in this statute. I always do this sometimes. I apologize. So you understand that the statute itself, all of the abuse things themselves, do not create a criminal cause of action. You still can be prosecuted for doing these things under any criminal law.
Yes, I didn't see the penalty clause in this bill, but
maybe it's because it's the same.
It could be in the other part of the statute.
I'll find
here,
it.
But
right.
That's why I asked. Just your personal opinion, do you really have we ever prosecuted somebody for failure to report, a health care professional for failure to make a report?
Representative Veazey, to my knowledge, there have been investigations about it, and professionals know that they've been investigated for it. To my knowledge, there has not actually been a criminal prosecution taken to the courts. We'd have to check with Division of Family Services. That's my personal knowledge about it.
When I was employed as a medical provider, that was one of the big concerns we had, that teaching nursing students that, yes, if they did see an inappropriate action, that they needed to be able to take that, and there was our obligation to take that to the nursing supervisor and to follow that through, and if it didn't go further than that, it wasn't reconciled. It was their duty to do something about to continue So I think as much as we hate to think that this goes on, this is as bad as child abuse. And there are cases with a growing number of seniors we have in the state that this is definitely something that needs to be.
I think the reasoning for my question is this the sort of umbrella we want to put our health care providers under? You've already mentioned that in most cases, this information, if they fail to comply with the law, this information is transmitted to their licensing board. And we are dealing with licensed professionals in all cases. But a person is being put in a position of being subject to, and I can't remember what a Class B felony is, several $1,000 fine or 6 months in prison. They're being put in a position having their professional judgment questioned under threat of criminal penalty. I question whether that's appropriate to promote good health care.
Representative Veazey, if I may, through the chairs, I think one of the schemes on elder abuse and child abuse reporting is that this duty to report also comes with it an immunity from being sued for reporting or for any action being taken against the reporter. It's a two-edged sword and protection, if you were, for the professional, because it makes sure the professional knows he also has protection, that no one can sue him for slander or libel if he reports, and at the same time, the force of him needing to report is very clear from the law's point of view. And so I think, in fact, it's a balance, like many other of our whistleblower and protective statutes are, that we say to somebody, you must report, and so everyone knows we're serious about that. It has a penalty for it, but it also comes then with it the immunity sections from liability that are back in Section 6 of the bill. I mean, it's an attempt to balance it, I think.
Well, thank you for your answer.
Yeah.
Thank you. Any other questions from this committee?
Madam Chair, if I could, for Representative Veazey, I'm sorry that I couldn't put my finger on the line. It's on page 3. The criminal penalty for failing to comply to report is is a guilty of a violation is defined in AS 11. It's at line 5 of page 3. And then that, I believe, if I still look at it, is a Class B felony for failure to report.
Well, a violation is not a felony. It's a violation.
That's right. A violation. That's right. It's a violation of this criminal code.
Fine.
I think you might be right. Maybe I'm saying.
I believe a violation.
Am I saying misdemeanor or felony when I should be saying misdemeanor? I'm sorry if I've erred on that. I will look it up and get it to you.
Any other questions? Do you want to continue?
I can give you more on this bill, or I can move to the other bill.
Continue with this bill. We might
okay. Would you like a sectional analysis, or how would you like to go through it?
Just one moment, please. Thank you. If you want to continue, and then I'll take testimony for this one specific bill. It is my intention, if there aren't a whole bunch of questions and people have questions with amendments, I would like to move, if everybody's comfortable with this bill on today, if that's possible. If we have time for the next bill, then we'll move that. Otherwise, we'll hear this one, and I'd like to continue and finish with this one if we could.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'll give you a real brief overview of what we're talking about, too. In fiscal year 93, there were a total of 408 reports of harms to adults made to DFYS. And of those, about 200 were of the elderly and of people over age 65. The next group was in age 60 to 65, and the rest were between 18 and 59. Quite a few of them, over 38%, were, in fact, requests for services. They, in fact, were not. They were requests that we think there's somebody in our neighborhood who needs services, which is why we think tying this in more closely with the senior and the developmentally disabled service networks makes sense. 23% of those were of neglect, and most of that was of self-neglect, which is a person who's old, sick, doesn't have family, and people around are worried. Economic harm was 6%. Physical abuse was 20%. And then other sort of categories of things put together came to about 13%. So I want to give you a little bit of background that we're talking not about a huge problem, but a growing problem. It definitely has grown. The numbers of reports have doubled since fiscal year 85.
Thank you. Back to the idea of people who fail to report are guilty of a violation, do you have information on in the last year, how many cases or instances there may have been of people guilty of failure to report?
Chairman Bundy, and I'd have to check, and Family Services is probably here, someone here from Health and Social Services, I don't think there have been any prosecutions. I think what happens is since the child abuse and elder abuse reporting laws came into our state in the early 80s, is most professionals have been trained repeatedly and are aware of this duty to report. And so it's a real rare instance that what Family Services is worried about is someone who didn't report. It's more likely that they're trying to keep up with the reports that we've got. We have some reports, incidental reports, that there are some people who don't report to the system because they're not sure that they'll get enough information back or that they're worried. And we think, in fact, that's part of where using the current service networks, the local networks more, may actually improve the reporting because they'll feel more a part of it or that they will get the information they need back to get to work with their clients. This is not to fault Family Services. It's just to say that we hear that anecdotally. And I'm aware of just one investigation that involved a grantee of Older Alaskans Commission about a failure to report. And it was very arguable whether or not they failed to report or whether they'd reported before and just weren't continuing to report.
Oh, this is not a significant problem, and the verbiage is there simply to plug an eventual hole.
I think it's there to plug a hole, yes. Okay, if
Madam
I can...
No,
sorry.
Yes,
are we
I'm
into
sorry.
Discussion of the bill itself now?
If you have any more...
I can either give you sectionals or I can answer questions, however you'd like it.
I wanted to ask about Section 6 of the bill.
Okay.
Section 6 of the bill, a little different from what's in the statute at this time. Tell me exactly what does this mean, because what my understanding of it is, it's not the professionals do not report what needs to be reported, But in those instances where they have reported and it was not substantiated, and then the individual or the family want to sue the professional for making the report, what kind of protection do they have in this bill?
Representative Davis, through the chairs, the current law for both elder abuse reporting and disabled abuse reporting had some immunity and liability sections, and what's happened is they've been combined in this bill. And the Department of Law went over this section carefully to be sure that the immunity from liability and prohibition against retaliation is as broad as we offer in any other state whistleblower statute, so that the person who makes a good faith report, whether they're required to do so and they're in that list of required people, or just whether they do it voluntarily, they're immune from any civil or criminal liability because they made that report. So although someone could sue them, it would be dismissed as quickly, very, very, very quickly.
Who pays the bill?
That it would, as most whistleblower statutes do, the state does not actually have, I don't think, pick that up. But it's because of this broad, you know, you don't see many lawsuits brought because of this broad protection. It's an absolute immunity in civil or criminal liability. I am not aware of any such lawsuits.
I am. Are you?
I'm aware more of the second, which is the retaliation, like in a job employment section. And that is clarified by this bill. That was not as strongly stated in the prior bills. And subsection B makes it clear that, say, if like an employee in a facility makes a report, that nobody above them or employees next to them may retaliate against them.
I'd like to have a real explanation of what actually would be provided to the person that has this happen out of section 6. You're saying that the case would be dismissed, but the burden of proof is still on the person that introduced the information to you. They would have to pay for their lawyers. They would have to pay all that. Would they in turn be reimbursed up under this statute?
Representative Davis, to my knowledge, this statute itself doesn't do that. We might want to double check with the Department of Law or with DFYS of whether they have ever helped represent someone from a state's point of view who's been brought for that sort of thing. I don't know if Pat O'Brien, for someone from DFYS, could perhaps check on that. The statute itself, on its terms, words, doesn't make that happen.
There are some people from the department, if they want to
happen.
Speak to that. Yeah. Would you allow them to do
certainly.
So?
Certainly. We'd certainly be glad to. Is there anybody in the room that can speak to it?
I don't believe I know anyone here that can speak to that at this time.
Fine.
Thank you. Is that it, Representative Davis?
I would like to have that information,
yes,
but
yeah.
I would not hold the bill up for that.
Going on to judiciary after this.
Correct, and that's
we can have it answered there. Thank you very much. Could you continue?
Sure. Okay, thank you. Basically, I think that the first sections of the bill define the protected class as vulnerable, and as I said, that is just a matter of also and use the new definitions of abandonment, exploitation, abuse, neglect. And I think I've gone over that. If you look as the first section continues on to page 2, the bill does amend the list of these people who are required reporters and has added a few people. And generally, I'll just talk about abuse instead of all the types of harm. And it has most of the amendments in that list are to bring words up with current practice in state government. And these are the same people as were covered before. Health and Social Services employees, Older Alaskans Commission's grantee employees, Council on Domestic Violence, Sexual Assault grantees. People had considered in the past that they were to be covered, and that language is bringing them up current to date. At line 17, subsection 12, an employee of a personal care is now the word used instead of homemaker program. And what has been added at line 21 is also a caregiver of the vulnerable adult, so that if there's anyone else who's not in one of these licensed professions and yet who's a caregiver, that they also are required to report. The bill continues also to clarify, if you go to page 3 in subsection E, starting at page 17, or line 17 through 25, that if a person who's making a report finds that they cannot get hold of the department's information number or can't get immediate response, weather or distance or whatever, that they may then in turn make the report instead to the nearest police officer. And the police officer can take immediate action to protect the vulnerable adult and then in turn notify the department. This is similar to what's in law now, but it's a little bit different to make clear that the reporting person has the choice of reporting to the police, and it's when they see an imminent risk of harm. If you go to subsection F, starting at line 26 of page 3, this is one of our attempts to streamline reporting. And it says that if a person who's supposed to report does it to the long-term care ombudsman, which is a federally required person who works in the Older Alaskans Commission, or to the Department of Health and Social Services, say the Medicaid Licensing Bureau, anyone else who has a function, an official role, if they make the report there by mistake instead of to our division, that they will have been considered to have met their duty to report. So we want to make sure they don't get caught in some technical violation because they report to some other part of state government that they see also has some kind of jurisdiction over this issue. And then the next parts, as you move to page 4, there's a lot of deletion of the immunity and retaliation sections, which are then put together in Section 6 that we just discussed with Representative Davis. Section 2 of the bill, starting at line 22 on page 4, describes the duties of the department on the amended law. And this is a new section, and it pulls together everything that the department's supposed to do, including, obviously, run a whole system for doing this, compile information, keep a central information system going, develop a statewide system that serves these people. And I think what's especially new would be subsections 4 and 5 at the top of page 5, lines 2 through 7, to establish criteria and procedures for authorizing and supervising other state agencies or community-based service providers who may serve as designees. And this is what I was talking about earlier, that if, say, the care coordination agency out of the home or senior center is willing to serve as a designee to go contact Mrs. Smith, whom they've had some contact with, to make sure she knows there's offers of help and to see if she wishes to confide that, in fact, there is the suspected abuse, that they may do that if they're willing. There's not a provision for the state to compensate them for that. It's more a matter of using them in services that they're already providing and so on. And DFYS has been doing this with some success, actually, for a few years, but their statute was not as clear about setting up a system for it. And basically, we would go on with maintaining records and confidentiality and so on, very similar to the current law, and could adopt regulations if necessary to carry out the purposes of the chapter. The next subsection, starting at line 14 of page 5, just basically talks about, again, trying to streamline some of the reports of abuse, and says that when a person who is the subject of the report is over age 60 and lives in an out-of-home care facility, that if that report of harm comes to the Division of Senior Services, it will be referred for all handling to two places, to the long-term care ombudsman and to the licensing branch in Health and Social Services that licenses that nursing home, or if it's an adult out-of-care home that they license, it will go to their licensing agency. And the ombudsman's office and the licensing agent will have the duty to carry out the provisions of this bill and refer it back if they find it's not appropriate for them to handle. Otherwise, they handle it. And we get one more state worker out of the situation. The protective social worker doesn't also have to go to this home as well as those two agencies. Subsection B talks about when it's a person less than 60 years of age, where the long-term care ombudsman doesn't have any jurisdiction, that the report then goes to the licensing agency in Health and Social Services. And that we say Health and Social has several different licensing sections. So the rest of those subsections at the top of page 6, C and D and so on, talk about the fact that those other agencies have to conduct the investigations, coordinate it, and provide all the results of their actions back to the central office within a specified time period, 60 days. And if they find somehow that it's not appropriate, that in fact this harm is being done by the person's family who they visit on the weekend, it's not being done inside the nursing home, then they may refer it back and the Division of Senior Services would handle the finish the case. The subsection that starts action on reports at line 24 on page 6 talks about what the department will do, that it will promptly initiate an investigation either itself or through a designee, and that we will conduct a face-to-face interview with the subject who is of the report unless they're unconscious or we think that a face-to-face interview actually puts them in further danger. And that is similar to current law, although it gives us these two exceptions about if they're unconscious or if it actually seems that it would put them in further risk to see them face-to-face, and maybe a telephone call would be a better way to contact them when the perpetrator won't be know what's happening. So that's similar to current law, but gives us, I think, more flexibility. Current law requires a mandatory face-to-face interview. Subsection B, which starts at the top of page 7, just is kind of your normal sort of setting up of a good procedure that after the department finishes its investigation, you have to have written reports with findings and recommendations that have to be put on file. And in C, I think an important part of this, line 11 on page 7, is the fact that we will terminate an investigation when the vulnerable adult requests it. That's current law. The additional new part is the fact that goes on that says, however, if the investigation at that point has already resulted in reasonable cause for the agency to believe that the vulnerable adult is in need of protective services, the department may petition the court for permission to give protective services, for a conservatorship, a guardianship, for a mental evaluation, or for an injunction against the perpetrator from harm, or the department, if it thinks it's serious enough, may refer the report to a police officer for criminal investigation. Because there's been some ambiguity about that in the past, whether literally, even though everything else we know says there's harm, if the competent but perhaps fearful victim says no, were we really supposed to close the case and walk away and let them continue to be harmed in a serious and grave manner? And there have been life-threatening situations where this question comes up. So this is somewhat new to point it out to you. And then after that, at page 23 of line 7, starts the new section allowing the use of surrogate decision makers for vulnerable adults. First, the department has to do enough investigation to decide that the vulnerable adult seems to really need protective services, but that the department has to be in a situation where it cannot obtain that person's consent to receive those services because they either lack the decision-making capacity, which is what you talk about when someone looks like they need a guardianship, and there are legal standards and cases and how that's determined, or they're unable to consent, which is defined further in the law as being temporarily unable for a physical reason or because they're under such coercion and fear that they cannot consent, but they're sending off other signals asking for help, and they have no guardian, then we may select, the department could use one of these individuals just for the purpose of giving initial consent to some protective services. And it honors traditional family lines, goes down through the spouse, the adult children, the parents, the brothers, and gives a provision at lines 15 through 27 on page 8 for how you use a surrogate decision maker if it's not clear who the top person should be. You can't use the perpetrator. You can't use someone who themselves seems incapable of making consent. And if you say you're at the level of using one of the adult children, and there are three adult children, all available and all willing to serve as the surrogate decision makers, there's a provision that they have to either act by a majority vote or consensus, and they can choose which way they do it. And if they couldn't agree, then clearly, at some point, the department would still have to go to court and use the more cumbersome and slow guardianship procedure instead, just to even get this initial consent to services. Madam Chairman.
Question. You're assuming that this person is surrounded by loving family.
Right. If they're not, we'll use them what we have to do now, which is to always have to go into court. And guardianships are not that easy to get. We have a very good guardianship statute, and it takes up to 90 days to get a guardianship. And as I said, this is modeled after law in about 17 or 18 states. The next section, which starts at line 28 of page 8, the delivery of protective services, says that when the department determines the person's in need of these services and someone has consented to the services, and then to the extent that our resources are available, then we ensure that the protective services are provided within 10 working days after receiving the report. And so we had, obviously, to honor the state's budgetary restrictions and other things, to know that we don't have everything for everybody, and there may be times when we can't give them all the protective services they might seem to need. Emergency. And finally, something that we added in this law, not in current law, but, of course, I think in current practice, at line 16 of page 9, that subsection C, that protective services are supposed to be provided in a culturally relevant manner, and it's supposed to protect the vulnerable adult's right to a least restrictive environment and maximizing their own decision-making capabilities. If someone is choosing to live where they want to live in a way that the rest of us aren't comfortable with, that isn't a reason to put them in protective services or in custody. They get to make that choice of how they live. So we want to mention that specifically in the law to make sure everyone remembers that balance point. Then in what's one of the new sections of the bill, very new by current law, is at page 9, starts at line 20, is to lay out exactly how the department petitions the court for protective services. This pretty much reflects current practice, but this puts it in one place in law to make it clearer that when we have reason to believe that someone's in need and is incapacitated, can't consent to services, we may petition the court for appointment of a guardian or a temporary guardian just for the purpose of deciding whether to consent to services. Because sometimes when you get somebody served and get their medical condition cleared up, their capacity to decide may return. In subsection B, if we have reason to believe they're mentally ill and of serious risk to themselves or others, we could petition the court for an involuntary commitment, and that procedure is already set up in other law, so we just reference it. The top of page 10, if someone has consented to receive services, but they're prevented by a caregiver or the perpetrator from getting the services, we could assist them or could ourselves, the department, petition the court for an injunction to restrain the caregiver from interference. And that's somewhat like a domestic violence writ. Ask someone to stay away or and so on. We have a duty to monitor, added by Section 3, to monitor their ongoing situation until we determine that protective services are no longer needed. Section 4 of the bill amends current law. It keeps the heart of that law, which is that reports are confidential, and that they. But it does change it slightly at lines 19 through 20, which used to say that investigation reports could only be used by appropriate governmental agencies inside and outside the state. And it now says appropriate agencies or individuals. And this will allow the department in its designation agreements to say that a certain agency such as Circle of Care, Care Coordination Agency, if it's in a designation agreement honoring confidentiality, can get some of this confidential information as it needs it to deal with a particular client. It's not a governmental agency, but it could be an appropriate agency under regulations issued by the department and with the proper strictures put around their use of the information on a need-to-know kind of basis, not just generally that they can have access to all of the files. But in the past, the restriction was to only other governmental agencies could ever get any of this information. It still has to be very closely guarded to protect the vulnerable adult, obviously. And then also subsection B goes on to state that we have to disclose the reports to the subject of the report we will disclose it if the subject of the report consents in writing, and also we'll always disclose the number of verified reports of harm that occur at an out-of-home care institution. We'll keep those kind of records. If you want to find out how many reports of harm have happened at a particular adult foster care or nursing home, we're to have that information available and can make it public. Finally, subsection 5, which starts at the bottom, page 10, allows regulations to be adopted but says that they have to be provided to and reviewed by the Older Alaskans Commission. That's the same as current law. Section 6, which Representative Davis brought up, is the section about immunity from liability and the prohibition of any retaliation. And then finally, subsection 7 are the definitions. And just drawing your attention to the highlights, abuse at line 21 on page 11 is now the willful, intentional, or reckless, non-accidental, and non-therapeutic infliction of physical pain, injury, or mental distress, or its sexual assault as defined in certain criminal laws. And let me point out the difference. Currently, abuse is the infliction of any pain, physical pain, period, on a person. It goes on to say, or any mental pain that requires professional caregiver help. But any physical pain, whether it's accidental or not, whether it's something that happens in the process of physical rehabilitation at a nursing home, if someone cries out in pain and says, this was too rough, or if someone is accidentally dropped and transferred to the bed, then everyone gets in a situation where all the other employees feel they are compelled to report, even though the particular person involved is remorseful, has no history of doing this, is not careless, but has caused an accident, and there's accidental pain. We wanted to try to move away from that burden and misuse of state resources. We also define, I think, sometimes for the first time, we define what a caregiver is, and it's a person providing care, either as a result of a family or who has assumed responsibility for the care, either voluntarily by contract or by court order. So, for instance, if a guardian was abusing someone or taking advantage. And then we go on. The other things that are new in the definitions, I think most of the other definitions tie us in with current statutes about incapacitated person and so on. I mentioned already neglect, meaning intentional failure to provide care, not just inability or poverty. You might want to know what protective services are. That's at subsection 11, line 18, page 12. Protective services are those intended to prevent or alleviating the harm resulting from this abandonment, exploitation, abuse, and that are provided to a vulnerable adult in need of protection. So they're not everything that the person necessarily needs for the rest of their life, but it's a thing you do to stop or cure the harm immediately, and then you get them into some more permanent kind of care situation or back to independent living or whatever it takes. And also, I think it's important we did define what unable to consent means at subsection 14, the refusal or inability to accept services because they're either incapacitated or at the top of page 13, they may be in coercion or living in fear of reprisal from the perpetrator, they may be so dependent on the perpetrator, or they may have an inability to perceive that their refusal consent is going to result in imminent and substantial danger of death or irreparable harm to themselves or others. And all of this is work that we did with Family Youth Services and with care providers and with the senior network to try to cover the kinds of situations we actually see arise. So then finally the last sections, as I said, are just transition sections with the bill taking effect right away on July 1 of 1994.
Are there any questions from the committee?
Do we have public testimony?
Yes, we do. Dennis Murray, Representative Beeson.
Thank you, Madam Chairman.
Yeah.
I couldn't help but notice that we're deleting a fair amount of existing statute, and then it appears very similar wording is being reinserted somewhere else. Is there a reason for this?
Madam Chairman, Representative Veazey, yes, partially it's because there were two separate laws before. There was literally a separate section that repeated some of the same things, abuse of the elderly and abuse of disabled adults, and so we're merging the two. And so one part of one had to be deleted so that they could be combined.
Okay.
And so when the Attorney General was putting them together, that's what they ended up doing, was taking out a fair amount so that there's one statute instead of two.
Thank you. And I have trouble with the term abuse. I'm not sure if I know what the therapeutic infliction of physical pain is, but whenever you have a close communal relationship, some sort of family relationship, there is going to be physical contact and interrelations among these people. Some person's idea of physical pain and my idea of physical pain are not one and the same. I don't have any examples in mind in terms of disabled adults or incompetent adults, but that just seems awful vague and open to a considerable abuse, in my opinion. In two directions. One, I have no idea what therapeutic infliction of pain is, but the other thing, infliction of pain just in general, is a very, very subjective term.
I represent Veazey, if I may, through the chairs. The therapeutic infliction of pain is meant to get at, for instance, if you have to, is it the right term, if I use the right nursing term, to debride the skin between someone's toes, an older person, so that fungus and other things don't grow. It is sometimes painful to do it, but it's necessary to prevent fungus infection from regrowing. And for instance, physical therapy in nursing home settings, when you're pushing a person to, you know, re-extend an arm that's been constricted after a stroke, there is pain involved in it, but it's a therapeutic pain. In other words, it has a professional medical meaning that you're trying to actually, you have a plan of therapy that, and part of it sometimes inflicts some pain upon the person. Our problem is actually we're trying to clarify now any infliction of pain under current law, even if it's done under therapy, can be reported by someone and has to be investigated. So that's what we're trying to do. You're right. I mean, this whole area, remember, since it's not a criminal statute and since we're trying to cover a wide range of contingencies and yet not get too interfering, we're always striving to find a best balance, but it's not going to cover everything nor prevent some misinterpretation. That's where the social workers and the protective service workers have to be trained to not interfere in things that are just normal physical contact. But I understand what you're saying, but the therapy has it refers back to the professional term therapy.
May I interject? Mr. Representative Veazey, someday you will know what therapeutic pain is when you go to trim your toenails.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair.
Stretching.
I think I have experienced my share of pain and suffering through life. Thank you. I am concerned. I realize the current law. I have considerable problems with current law. And if I was going to err in this area, it would be in favor of the family unit as opposed to the favor of the state's guardianship obligations. And I'm sure that this has been wrestled with quite a bit, but I'm still not comfortable with it.
Are you finished?
Yes, thank you.
Are there any more questions concerning this? Is there anybody in the audience who would like to testify? Thank you very much. We have other people testifying for 377 rather than this bill. Is there anybody out there who would like to testify? If you'd like to come up to the table, please just state your name and address, etc., for the record.
I'm Pat O'Brien from the Department of Health and Social Services, Division of Family and Youth Services, and I'm sorry I was late today. I understand there were a couple questions that came up before I got here, but I've been told what they were. First, I'd just like to say that the Division of Family and Youth Services strongly supports moving the role of adult protection services out of the division over to the now Division of Senior Services. We've worked very closely with them in creating this. We have tried for a number of years to get proper resources to carry out this function. It was not originally funded, and we don't feel very good about the community's lack of confidence in the division. Only about our estimated 1 in 8 reports of abuse or neglect come to our attention anyway. And if the community does not have confidence in the division that's carrying out this responsibility, then you get even fewer reports. So I just want to be real clear on the record that we are very, very supportive of this moving to the Division of Senior Services, where we believe it will grow stronger and become a good professional service over time.
Thank you. Pat, there had been a question by Representative Davis about if somebody in good faith reports a perceived abuse, and it's reduced to nothing, and it's found out that it was fine, and the people, the family of this reported victim turns around and sues the original caller. If that goes to court, who pays that court case? You've had, I'm sure, cases like that.
I'm sorry, Representative Tuohy, we've never had a case like that. So we've, Representative Tuohy, through the chair to Representative Davis, we've really not dealt with it, and I don't know how it would be handled if we did need
to. Could you just go through the procedure to tell me what you do at this time? Because there are people now who are fighting cases where they have reported abuse, and now the family is taking retaliation against them because it was not substantiated. And they, it's my understanding they don't get any assistance from the department because they say there's no money for that. Have it ever been reported to you that there are people out there that have this problem? Who would handle that if it's not in your division?
Through the chair to Representative Davis, I'm sorry, I don't know about those cases. So
maybe I would have a better understanding if you explain to me then what will take place if that happens.
If a family, if the reporter,
an individual who
if an individual
is required
who is
to report,
reports, and then some action is taken or not taken, and then they experience a lawsuit. I believe that the current statute has a provision in it that will indemnify them from being sued for that, and I need to look that up.
What I want you to tell me, what does it mean when you said it would indemnify them, and will it pay the court cost? If that's in here, that's, you know, that's good. That's not a problem. It's my understanding that this doesn't mean anything because the person would have to go to court, and then whatever the court would decide, who should get the award. And if it's decided against the reporter, they have to come up with the money.
Through the chair, I really think I need to research this and look into it. If there are actual cases out there, there may be circumstances that I can't guess at, and I think we should look into it.
Representative Bundy and then Representative...
Well, Section 6 says that they are immune from civil or criminal liability. I think that would say the judge would throw the case out. But maybe we need a legal opinion
on
whether the immunity really truly means you cannot be sued, period.
Thank you.
Because you're lifting this from the old statute, right?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, that's pretty much lifted.
Okay.
Did you have somebody on that same?
Maybe I can help from a sort of a put my legal hat on. Nothing can ever keep you from being sued.
Correct.
And then that always incur, and that can make a person have to incur some personal costs of even getting a lawyer and going to court long enough to say to the judge, I made this report in good faith, you must dismiss it. I suppose what could happen is that someone could try to open up the issue of whether they made the report in good faith. And I suppose that could draw them in. And I'm just trying to say very frankly, I don't know. I don't think the state has a system for the state to represent people or to indemnify them for the cost of doing that. But this legal provision has been there, and it's in the child abuse reporting laws, too, that in most instances the court would throw that part of the lawsuit out right away. But that is not the same as a state indemnification procedure, like making them whole or paying them back their attorney's fees.
Thank you. Thank you. I think if we can
That's
get
what
some
I wondered.
A handle on that, we'll bring it up again in judiciary. Thank you. Representative Veazey, you had a question? I'm sorry, you
Thank
finished?
You, Madam Chairman.
I'm done. I don't have any.
I was going to comment in regard to Representative Bette Davis's question that there is a big difference between immunity and indemnification. Mm-hmm. Those are not the same.
Yes.
My comment was that one of the big sections that is deleted is the old law, the law we're operating under now, current law. Provides immunity from civil liability unless otherwise provided by law, which opens up I don't know how many loopholes. The proposed law, as I understand it, just says that they are immune from civil or criminal liability, period. They're not indemnified for anything, but they are immune. I would characterize that as much stronger wording, but that doesn't change the litigious nature of the good faith intent, mm-hmm. nor does it indemnify anybody. So I don't know if that answers everything. Bette Davis is.
I was saying, would the state want to? I mean, what would you perceive as the cost that I don't even know how you estimate it? But what I hear is that once these things began to happen, the department right away says, well, no, there's nothing that we can do for you. This is where it is, and then all that's responsibility on you. And then if there are cases like that out there, and I've been told that they are because I have, and I didn't bring the information down here because it has nothing to do with this bill. I just wanted to make sure that this bill was stronger than what we have on the books already. And I guess you can tell me if it is or not, what it will do different from what the old one will do.
I think it's about the same, Betty. I don't think Representative Davis has addressed that concern of yours. It doesn't go that far.
Thank you. We will bring that up.
I will certainly follow up and inquire. I'm assuming the cases you speak of are in Anchorage and in the adult care field?
Yes, and if you want to contact my office, I can get that information to you.
Thank you. And I think what we'll do is pass the bill out and on, if that's the wish of the community, and then we will make sure that is the truth.
Yes, I'm not trying to hold the bill up.
I
want the bill to move on.
I know you.
If you have testimony, though, I think you need to take it.
We don't have any.
Oh, you don't?
Testimony.
Thank you.
Is there any further testimony? Hearing none, it's closed to public testimony. Representative Cott?
I had a question for
Go ahead.
The last witness. I'm not really clear as to what the current law is for notifying agencies for child abuse. Can you kind of clarify what the provisions are and what the penalty for not reporting that abuse would be? I'm trying to draw some correlation between what we're doing here on one end of the spectrum and perhaps what the laws are at the other end of the spectrum, because clearly those who fail to comply with a section is guilty of a violation, and a violation hardly anything. It's a $250 fine. We're not talking about a felony.
Through the chair, to Representative Knott, I would have to look it up. I haven't looked at the violation in the child abuse reporting law for some time. You make a good point, and I do think that law was looked at when we were developing this one. But I don't recall what it
is. I think
it's
probably the same.
It may very well be. Sorry.
And I might follow up if maybe someone that helped develop this could clarify on line 12, page 2, it talks about various individuals who are charged with the responsibility to report, and we have a member of the clergy. That, to me, and I'm really not sure why it's there, but it certainly sticks out among the rest of the individuals here that we're charging that responsibility to. They're all healthcare providers, with the exception of village safety officers and the police officer, who, under their own charter, are responsible for doing mm-hmm. such things. So I was kind of curious as to why you're interfering now with the clergy.
Representative Toohey, if I may answer Representative Cott's question, sort of from behind Pat here. Pat and I are doing a team.
To make sure you know you.
Okay, Connie Sykes speaking, answering the question. That is the current law for both children's and adults reporting, and it, of course, was a subject of a lot of debate in the 80s. In fact, I think it was added after the initial Child Abuse Reporting Act later in the 80s, wasn't it, Pat?
Mm-hmm.
There was a lot of debate about it, but
debate.
Eventually a legislative determination on that specific issue mm-hmm. that members of the clergy, because of the trust that they have given to them by families and family members, should speak out when they see actual abuse. And so we didn't change the current law. That is current law in both children and adults. And I was, I came into Working Health and Social Services a little bit after that debate had happened in about 1985 or 86, but there was quite a bit of debate and eventually a legislative determination to go that way.
Thank you. Did you have another question, Representative Cott?
I have a ton of them, but I'll hold them.
Representative Beasley, you had a question?
No, ma'am. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there no further questions from the
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'd like to move that House Bill 376 be moved out of the HES Committee with individual recommendations.
Is there objection? Hearing none, is so moved. Thank
with,
you.
With accompanying physical.
Yeah, and
physical.
Also with the yes.
With the
I,
yes.
I need to add that to it. Thank you very much.
So there's a physical note?
There's
quite a few.
You
No. Yeah. They balance out, but they're still there.
Yeah, but
yeah.
They're still
yeah.
there.
It's important to figure out.
All right. Moving on, we will hear testimony for House Bill 377, Regulation of Assisted Living Homes. We have three people signed up to testify, and Commissioner Missouri, you're happy with, you have given your testimony. Is there somebody else in the audience that would like to testify? We also have a letter for the record from the Homer Senior Citizens, I believe, is Denver already?
Yep.
That will go into on the record, and also Division of Pioneer Benefits, John Vowell, which we will introduce as testimony. Is there somebody who would like to speak that has not signed up?
Madam Chairman, I would just say that if you would like an overview, another section or a specific, what this bill does, Connie's just being volunteered.
You will. Is it the wish of the committee to hear a sectional again?
Yes,
I
would. Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. If you'd like to. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name is Connie Sipe, Director of the Division of Senior Services. The bill that creates assisted living licensing is, as you know, part of the Governor Hickel's initiative in the senior area. And again, part of what it does is to move a function into a new place in government, into two new places, in fact. This bill is meant to help both the elderly, age-in-place, and disabled people have choices for care that allow them to live in the community. And I will try to give you a sense of what it does and then go into a sectional. It does transfer, right now we have two kinds of licensing in the state for people who don't live at home but who don't live in a nursing home. We have something called adult foster care, and we have something called adult residential care levels 1 and 2, called ARCs, A-R-Cs, adult residential care, adult foster care, and adult residential care 1 and 2. And that is licensed as, those are licensed as facilities for, quote, dependent adults by the Division of Family and Youth Services. And they're under the same licensing law as child care centers, child care foster homes, maternity homes, orphanages, and sorts of other things. They're all in one licensing law. Again, working with the Department of Health and Social Services, this is a collaborative, agreed-upon effort. The licensing for any home that takes care of adults, and we drop the word dependent because we recognize that many of these consumers are not mentally dependent at all. They just have a physical disability. They are not wards of the state necessarily at all. That they are consumers or tenants, or whatever you want to call them. And we will move the licensure of the homes that deal with them out of Family Youth Services. So Family Youth Services will be left, if these two bills both pass, with things that deal primarily with families and children. That's their primary expertise. And then things that deal with adults will be moved to agencies that have adult programmatic responsibilities. So licensing homes that care for mostly for the elderly will be done by the Division of Senior Services. The elderly or the otherwise physically disabled, the person with MS who's 42 or an early heart attack victim at 50, it doesn't matter. Those people are more alike.
developmentally disabled group homes or group homes for the mentally ill or that sort of facility would be licensed by the Division of Mental Health and DD, which already has a service network which serves that type of individual. So this licensing bill would be used by two different agencies for two different kinds of facilities, and there is a provision in it for how we deal with facilities that have a mixed population so that they only have to be licensed once. There is a provision that the two agencies must do their regulations on that together on how to determine which group you primarily serve, and if you have a mixed population, or if you change your population, how you can just have one license, so that we aren't going to double team them. We've thought about that. We don't want to over-regulate. We want to encourage the development of these homes in the private sector. One of the big points of this bill is to, we want people to get supportive services and personal care attendant services, which are sometimes hands-on, simple tasks like bathing assistance and other types of assistance, but sometimes they need health care incidental to that personal care. They don't necessarily need 24-hour, around-the-clock scrutiny as in a nursing home. They may need a nurse once a day for a diabetes shot, two or three times a week to check on something. They may need a very routine help them to administer their own medications because they're mentally competent but their hand is shaky. This allows them access to some health care incidental to their personal care or their supportive services in the group home as a DD client and so on, which they cannot get now under current law. The current licensure of adult foster care and adult residential care does not allow a person, for instance, to get pretty much any kind of nursing care without being discharged and sent to a nursing facility. A person cannot be bedridden for 5 days with bronchitis. A person can be a child foster care and get a diabetes shot from his foster mother the day after his 18th birthday and he blows out the candles. It's illegal for her to give him the same diabetes shot. And so our laws now are talking about dependent adults, and we have a whole new philosophy shift here towards allowing consumers the kind of care they want without pushing them prematurely into nursing homes. We will always have a need for nursing homes. We have good nursing homes in the state. And we will always, I think, have enough population to fill the ones we have. But this is to allow consumers care in between as they choose it, and some people then to perhaps never be institutionalized in a home. The first section of the bill lists the purposes of the bill, and they are the things I said, to encourage care in home-like settings, to promote aging in place, to set out some reasonable standards to protect residents while honoring their independence, to require an assisted living plan for each resident, and to make sure that all residents have the maximum opportunity to both design and carry out their assisted living plan. This is sort of set up, a lot of it, like a landlord-tenant law or like our state's condominium law that sets out the rights and duties of the tenant and the landlord or the organization and the tenant so that they both have reciprocal disclosures guaranteed to them and then rights and responsibilities so they make their own decision. The state isn't placing these people in these homes. People are buying their own residence and their own services in these homes. This is not a payment mechanism. This does not guarantee anybody state payment for this service. It does not set up a state payment mechanism. It is just about the licensure. And, in fact, we hope it's the type of licensure that will allow flexibility. The next section of the bill, section 4733010, says who it applies to. It applies to any home that cares for more than two individuals not related to the caregiver. Currently, we license an adult foster care home with even one resident. And we believe that allowing private contracting between individuals and their families and one care provider, a retired nurse or whatever it is, who doesn't want to go into the business of caring for five people, like an adult foster care home can, but just wants to care for one person or, say, a married couple, that's why we said two, can be exempt from the statute from licensure. And that's up to a private party to set up that arrangement. If there's abuse or exploitation, we still have the abuse laws, we still have the criminal laws, but we would not have to regulate. We are deregulating the one- and two-person foster home who now is required to be fully licensed, even though they never intend to have more than one person in their home. We also, to distinguish what type of facility this is a facility that provides, whether it's in separate apartments or in kind of shared rooms or in a home, room and board, meals to their residents, and one more type of service. So if it's just the senior housing down the street and it has a cafeteria and rooms, it's not assisted living. If they then add one of the hands-on services listed, either assistance with the activities of daily living, such as eating, bathing, toileting, walking, dressing, or personal care assistance, which is a range of supported services and queuing services to developmentally disabled people, helping them go through their habilitation plans and so on, or health-related services. If they do one of those three things, they don't have to do all of them, but if they do any one of those things, then they become an assisted living facility. So Juno Senior Housing is going to build an apartment building down the street down here, and they're going to have at the front desk sort of a you know, a social director, coordinator who'd be glad to help you call your cab or set up an account for your groceries charge at Foodland. They're not doing personal care, hands-on kind of assistance or queuing you assistance. That isn't going to make them an assisted living facility. So it's a different sort of thing. And clearly then things like correctional facilities, alcohol treatment centers, emergency and runaway shelters, they're not included. Section 4733.020, health-related services, is a key part of the bill. It starts at the top of page 3. It's 2 pages long. This part of the bill is meant to settle a lot of uncertainty that goes on right now. As I've told you right now, people cannot get health care in an out-of-home facility. In an adult foster home, even if that's run by a registered nurse, may not give them any nursing care. They may not get that care. They may not be bedridden. And this part of the bill tries, and there's a lot of overlapping jurisdictions between the Board of Nursing, the licensing agency, the pharmacology board, and how much can you dispense medications, and is it dispensing to help someone get the spoon to their mouth even though they themselves know what medicine they're taking? There's a lot of overlapping jurisdictions. So this section is meant to clarify that these facilities may give some health-related services if they have the capacity, or they may allow the resident to bring in any community health care that they have a right to if they lived in their own home. If I live in my own home and I qualify for Medicare nursing, or I qualify for Project Choice nursing care, or I can private pay to bring in a nurse during my illness for 2 weeks in the winter, I can have that service come in to me when I live in an assisted living facility. Now I cannot have that service come in to me in adult foster care or an adult residential care because if I'm that sick, I may not be there at risk of the home losing its license. So it allows the person to have access to their own care from the community just like they would if they were still living in their house down the street. Or it allows the facility, if the facility has the kind of staff to do it, to give them some limited health-related care. It is not meant to recreate nursing homes, you know, and that's a line that we have to find and draw. Again, and the homes are not required to provide these services. So some homes say, I'm just, you know, a nice home and I'll help you with baths, but boy, if it gets into a lot of nursing care, you're going to have to move out. They can do that. They set their rules up front in their disclosure of what services their home provides. And they can make that. They also, as they go through with any individual client, the home always has the right to say, no, now you're getting into something that's beyond what we ever contemplated. I'm not willing to have someone be responsible for someone with this great health care need in my little home. No, you're going to have to find another place to live. The home always has that control. And listed briefly, what the section does is allows assistance with self-administration medications, the simple assistances, just like measuring, tracking for people, keeping track, reassuring them that they're really taking the right thing and that, yes, they did take it at supper and now it's okay to take it again at bedtime, guiding and helping someone who's mentally capable who requests that you help them get the medicine to their mouth. So that clears up an ambiguity. Then the sections go on to say that you can provide some intermittent nursing care, less than 24-hour care. This is what I think of as the nurse a day or the nurse 3 times a week who gives a simple diabetes shot to a person who's stable and who is not needing a lot of monitoring of their condition. Then in subsection D in that 020, home staff only may, under a nurse's training and delegation, be allowed to perform certain limited nursing tasks. So in other words, a person who's not a nurse, not an RN, not an LPN, not even a certified nurse's aide, could be trained by a nurse and delegated a specific task. And we worked on this with the Board of Nursing. The Board of Nursing would set out the procedure for doing that and the types of tasks that can be delegated. In fact, the Board of Nursing has gotten ahead of us, and they've already issued this year, after our work on this last year, about an 8-page description of how this can be done anywhere in the state, not just in a licensed assisted living facility. Then also in subsection E, the home may either allow or arrange for a nurse from outside the home to come in and provide skilled nursing care. That's the private sector, whatever I can afford. The home, if it has the capability, may let this person have 24-hour skilled nursing care for up to 45 days in order to avoid transfer out of the home. It may also then let a person decide. And this is really giving people choice. This is a radical departure in some ways by letting people, the person who's ill, have the choice, not the profession, say how sick you are and what you can have. If the person has exhausted their 45 consecutive days of skilled nursing, if the facility had it, or if the facility doesn't have that capability, the person, the resident, and the person's physician may agree that the person can stay in the home without 24-hour nursing care. If they want to stay back to what a nurse a day or a nurse 3 times a week, and if that's what they want to stay, and everyone, including their physician, agree to it, they can stay, even though they might be eligible for nursing care 24 hours if they wanted to go into an institution. And then finally, if someone has used up their 45 days, but they're certified by their physician as being terminally ill, and again, everyone involved, including the facility and the doctor, agree the person wants to stay there and they're being adequately managed for pain or whatever, if they're terminally ill and don't want to move out the last month or two, they could even decide to die there. So this is a bill, a very strong consumer rights bill for persons who want to live in facilities. Again, it does not require any of these facilities to give all of these levels of care. They could give just level A, just level B. They could say, we don't deal with people dying in our small home. That's too hard on us. So it's permissive, and we hope it will be flexible for Alaska so that a small facility in Kotzebue or a large facility in Anchorage will, the market will develop what it wants to sell and what consumers want to buy in terms of a package of residential and personal care and health-related services that they will know what they're getting through the disclosures required, and they can decide what they want to have. A lot of the rest of the bill, and I've lumped it in some sections, if you take all the way from 4733.030 through 360, it's all standards for residents' rights and homes' duties. And it's very, very much like the state landlord-tenant law or the state condominium law. It lists out what happens with security deposits and advance payments have to go in trust accounts, just as they do for any landlord in the state has to put them in a trust account, so if he goes bankrupt, they don't go with him. It talks about temporary residences, talks about house rules and the fact that there can be house rules and that a house can decide we're a non-smoking house or we're a non-visitation house. You've got the residents have some rights, but the homes have also have rights that are balanced out. This section of the bill was taken from a Uniform Board and Care Act developed by the American Bar Association, American Association of Homes for the Aging, the National Long-Term Care Reform Committees, about 10 organizations who worked for this in the early 80s, and it was put out in about 1985 as a suggested statute that has kind of a balance of rights and duties on both parties. And it's meant to be to set the marketplace by not having the state regulate so much, but by having everybody have kind of, this is the playing field, here's your rights and your duties, here's your disclosures, here's what's required to be in a contract. Now you can make your own choices and buy your own care. You're not dependent adults. We'll just set the playing field. The market will develop it, and people will buy what they want. There's a section in the bill at the end that if the state pays for the care, if, for instance, under Project Choice, the Medicaid home care waiver, if we want to require or feel we need to require for some federal purpose some additional programmatic type of care, we can impose an additional care requirement as a condition to get public funding. But this is not about public funding. This is about the private sector. In Article 4 of the bill, as you get back into Sections 4733, 400 through 430, basically prohibit homes from calling themselves assisted living when they don't have a license or operating without a license, and allow the smaller homes that we have now, those who are called adult foster homes, which serve five or fewer persons, to continue to call themselves that. That was very important to them in meetings we had with their industry earlier this year, that they be able to refer themselves as adult foster care homes. They've developed an identity as such. The 4733.410 does what I mentioned earlier, divides up which homes will be licensed by which of the two agencies, and makes sure that the departments have to coordinate their regulations so that we don't make them get double licensed. A section following in 410 requires that the departments must produce standardized forms to help the facilities comply. So these things like these residents' rights, you know, disclosures and the standard admission contracts and plan of care, the department must come up with standardized forms that the homes are allowed to use but not required to use in order to help the small business. If they want to have a preset form they know complies with law, they can use the assisted living plan of care model form with the checkoff boxes from the department, or they can develop their own. But we were real interested in making sure we didn't over-regulate or overburden, and the state offered enough assistance in moving to this new kind of plan